I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
Hey ladies, very special episode of the program. We are here with only one guest this time, Chantelle Bisson. She's a woman of many talents, too numerous to mention. Seriously, her bio goes on and on and on, and I felt very inferior. She's also the co-owner of the Chantilly's Place Marina. And if the last name sounds familiar, yeah, she's married to Yannick Bisson of Murdoch Mysteries fame. She's here today though, because she's the author of a, pardon the pun, really cool book on parenting entitled Raising Your Kids Without Losing Your Cool. And I thought this is really well timed because it's a heat wave. People are out of, kids are out of school. School is canceled in many parts of Canada. Lots of people from working from home. Everybody is losing their cool literally and figuratively. So Chantelle, we're going to start in kind of the practical place. And I know you've answered this. I want to go deeper than your previous answers. Okay, I want to ask you why you decided to write this book. And you said it's because friends were having kids, all that stuff. Okay, that's kind of an answer, but why not just say, read this book that's already out there? What was missing? Why did you have to write a book on parenting?
It's funny to answer this question because the reality is, like, when I go to answer it, I'm like, are people going to think I'm an asshole? Are people going to think I'm arrogant? But the reality of why I wrote the book is I just didn't like the kids that I was running into. I didn't, you know, walking down the street, kids don't move out of the way anymore. They almost challenge you to walk into you. Like, I'm walking here. And I'm like, hey, twerp, when I was your age, we would go off the curb onto the road to let somebody who was older than us walk by. And it just was everywhere. It was driving me crazy. And I was watching our younger girl who's 23 come up through school. And to be blunt, I was pretty disgusted by this next generation that was coming up. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I don't have any letters after my name. So I sat on the notion of writing the book for a really, really long time because you were saying you felt in fear. I felt threatened and I felt like, well, who's going to listen? Who's going to care? I'm just a mom. But the more I walked around and felt uncomfortable with what I was seeing in these kids, I thought, what have I got to lose? You know, if I write a book about going back a little bit in time to, you know, consequence, discipline, structure, all the things that seem to have become dirty words in the parenting world, If my book impacts 100 parents to adapt and adopt some of these messages that I'm sending, then great. So we'll have 100, you know, fewer assholes out in society in 10 or 20 years.
I admit those were my two favorite chapters in the whole book, the one on boundaries and the one on discipline. Because like, I'll tell you, a lot of people I know, both with kids and without kids, they're like, I hate other kids. I hate my kids' friends. I hate the kids I encounter. I love my kids, but am I just blind or are other kids little utter creeps? And it is like, at some point, parents had to be their kids' friends instead of their parents. And, you know, I've talked to psychologists and that isn't good for kids. Kids need to know there are rules and structure. And I thought you're very honest through the whole book. And I found that really refreshing that you didn't try to be perfect. And yeah.
Well, okay. I wasn't perfect. I was a nightmare a lot of the times in my mom journey. You know, I lost my cool all over the place. And that's why I titled the book this, because the other reason I wrote it is because I have, you know, girlfriends of mine whose daughters are now having kids. My girls are thinking about having kids. And I see on social media this whole other world of the new mom, the mommy blogger, and the mom on Instagram, and their lives look pristine and their kids look perfect and everybody's happy and they have money and they have great clothes and their dinners are all, you know, they use the same filter for every single thing they post. And I watched how that is adding such a layer of stress on my friends whose daughters already have kids and how they're feeling like they just are not measuring up. And are they ever going to be good enough? Are they ever going to look good enough? And the reality is that parenting is not about perfection. Mm-hmm. Parenting is about messing up, owning it, apologizing, pivoting, and correcting whatever mistake you made as the parent, or helping your child correct their way of being in a situation so that you're not always on this hamster wheel of like, oh my God, why does my kid just scream for what they want? Why don't they use their words? Well, have you told them to use their words? Like, have you given them a consequence when they don't use the words, when they're throwing themselves around on the ground, rolling around like they've just been stung by a horde of wasps? You know what I mean? Like writhing in pain, and all you did was say, no, they can't have a soda. So I felt like it was the time. I don't know. It hit me that now was the time. And trust me, when the book came out and we were knee deep into the pandemic, I thought, and this is the recovering actress in me, I thought I wanted to die when my book was like coming out without a launch, no on-air appearances, no fanfare, everything was, I was going to have to rely on social media. My social media numbers, if I were a mommy blogger, suck. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a lot of followers. Yannick, even though he's hugely successful, has been in the business for 37 years, his numbers kind of suck.
It's a totally different thing with, yeah, established yeah. performers. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, you know, it would, I lost my cool yeah. even when the book was supposed to come out. So I don't know. I just, it was more to do with listening to my girls talk about how hard it is to find a good man.
Interesting.
To date. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's a parenting issue.
Which you have written about. I loved that article. That it was short, but it really made the point. And you're not afraid to knowingly dig at people. Like, you know, you're picking a scab in places, but you go there anyway. And I really respect that about your writing, because there's such a pressure to be nice and be other oriented, especially in female spaces and female writing. But you just go there, like, real talk here. Like, let's spend more time teaching our boys to be good people.
Yeah. And
you said it in a way that wasn't jargon filled. It didn't feel touchy feely. It wasn't full of like buzzwords. And I thought it was really effective. But at the same time, what kind of terrifies me is I hear this from mothers and from young women over and over and over again, that boys aren't being taught to be girls. We're highly protective of our girls.
Yeah.
We are not giving boys that structure. And as you said, they don't learn it on their own.
No. I took a lot of heat for that article, by the way, and happily so, because, you know, if you're getting upset, then you're part of the problem. Because the people who are already calling their boys to that standard of living, what's there to be upset about? You're like, cool. You're like, I'm already doing that. I'm mm-hmm. ahead of you. You know, I find that when you pick a scab, the only reason the scab hurts is because the wound's not healed yet. And it's the same kind of thing. Like when you go head on in a conversation on a topic, if you get a reaction out of people, chances are it's because there is a part of them that has some ownership in that, creating that problem. And the other thing that I find interesting about you saying, like, I don't use buzzwords and I don't use touchy-feely and I'm not very politically correct in my writing. And the reason I'm not is because let's be frank, but everybody who's listening, let's all just call a spade a spade. When we are at home inside our own four walls, we are not politically correct anyway. So then we go out in the world and we're all like accepting of whatever everybody wants you to be. And then you go home and you're like, I don't really agree with that. I don't really subscribe to that. But we're all afraid to say that we don't, because we don't want people to be mad at us. But the reality is how I see things. Now, not everybody's going to agree with me, and that's fine. But don't come at me to try to change my mind on where I stand and what I think. Just like, I'm not going to try to get you to change your mind. Buy my book. You like it, you don't like it. You implement it, you don't implement it. Fine. You don't have to write a scathing email telling me how horrible I am, how wrong I am. You can think it and feel it, and you're totally entitled to do that. Just like, you know, I can think and feel all the things I want in the world. Am I going to write a friggin', am I going to comment on every person's, you know, when I think somebody's like overdressed right now, it's a pandemic and they're still doing their fashion thing. And I'm like, guys, it's so tone deaf, but am I going to write that? No, if you feel good, you look pretty and it makes you happy. It's your feed. Do what you want.
You did go there once though, and I thought I was alone before I read this in your book about your hatred of gender reveal parties.
Oh, okay.
And I thought I was alone. I have some of them I've been to have been lovely because they've said it's just an excuse for a party. But to me,
it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just have a party in my mind. The best one I went to was part costume party, part gender reveal party, and they messed up the gender reveal and they're whatever, it's pancake, you know. But yeah. Others, it's like you are setting expectations and programming your children while they're still in utero. And it was so refreshing to hear somebody who's had three girls feel sort of the same way of this is stupid and say it in a book and be prepared to take the crap for it.
Yeah.
Is there anything you hold back just because it's too nuclear and, you know, it may cascade onto Yannick and like cancel culture and everything like that? Or you're just kind of like, whatever, we'll live.
You know, interesting. So our two of our very, very best friends on the planet are Rick Springfield and his wife, Barbie Springfield. For people who are listening and don't know about Yannick and I, he and Rick did a series together back in, gosh, our 29-year-old was two, so 27 years ago. Mm-hmm. They played brothers. They did this show for 3 years. Rick wrote a book, and everybody knows about the book because it's out there. It's mm-hmm. his memoir, and he wrote about his depression and his mental illness and all the things. But what he also did was he wrote about things that he did in his marriage to his wife mm-hmm. that only they had ever known about. It was private and it was between them. And he put it all in the book. Mm-hmm. And I watched as a best friend, I watched how that hurt her. Because it was one thing for her to live it and deal with it and go through it and process it. And it was another thing for everybody to now know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so when I wrote my book, and when I'm now writing the teen book, Parenting Your Teen Without Losing Your Cool, and I will write a relationship book, I held a lot back. I held a lot. I gave scenarios of what we went through, but I didn't say which daughter it was. I didn't get into specifics. I didn't share their private stories because like I say in my book, your child doesn't belong to you. You don't own that child. Putting them all over your social media for likes and upping your brand, I'm against that because there's going to be a day when they become big enough that they're going to be like, damn, why'd you do that to me?
I thought that was really classy. That's what I was going for. I noticed you kind of pulling back and hinting and, you know, talking about bad times and talking about, you know, one of them was just being a little, but I really respected the fact that you didn't go there because you'd have to ask a young 20-year-old whether it's okay. They don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't know. And they may think it's not okay now.
Right.
But going forward, they might think it's okay. And I have another example of why I pulled back and I held back in a lot of ways is I have this beautiful girlfriend who I love and we've been close for so, so long. And her pregnancy birthing story was really difficult, but she came out of it on the other side and they have got the most incredible child. Mm-hmm. And there were so many things that she did throughout that I was in awe of mm-hmm. and that I wanted to literally write an entire chapter of if this is you, these are some of the things that you can do to save it, to change it, to turn it around. And I wrote it and then I sent it to her and I asked her and she goes, no, that's my story. And I was like, yes. And that was another lesson to me that because these things have impacted me, I don't own them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this book also with that in mind, that I don't own all these stories. I only own half of them and the other half belong to the people that experienced it with me. So I was mindful with that when I wrote the book.
Now you seem just through the book and the articles and the fact that you apparently like moving houses. I could talk to you for an hour with that. There's a book, How to Enjoy Moving.
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny because that was initially, that was going to be the first one I wrote, Moving Without Losing Your Cool. Oh,
please write it because I don't know how. I need to know the foo, but you seem really comfortable with change, like really comfortable with change. I think a lot, I remember when in the book, you were in labor and Yannick was in New Zealand and I was like, oh God, that would have been a deal breaker for a lot of people. Now, yeah. Okay, you're a performer. That's part of it. You married a performer, you knew what you were getting into, but still, how do you get that good at facing the unknown?
Well, I'll tell you, I have to totally take ownership for that, that move, that Dominique being born without her dad, because we were 21, 22, living in New Zealand. I'd never been further than Florida in my entire, well, I lie. Puerto Rico was the furthest I'd ever gotten to before that. And you know, he was filming. We had our oldest girl who was not yet two. And I was meant to stay right till end of filming with him and have Dominique there so he could be there so he wouldn't miss it. And I pulled a move. I left him in New Zealand and came back to Canada because he was 21, 22 and he was surfing instead of spending time with me and, you know,
there's also a culture when you're working in the media that I think a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah.
It consumes you.
Yeah.
You become a different person.
Totally different
person. Yeah.
And, you know, he was buddying up with all the Kiwis and they were going for beers after, and he was living his life like none of that was happening. Like there wasn't a rambunctious climbing out of her crib, going to the playground when she's supposed to be napping, or shaving her legs when she's supposed to be napping, you know, all the things. And I'm pregnant. I'm just trying to catch some sleep. And yeah, so I was like, no, I'm not doing this. So that's on me. And even though she knows that I left and came to be with my mom and be with my family in the city where I knew people, where I wouldn't be alone, she has a harder time with him missing being there than being upset with me for making the call to leave. So it was hard. It definitely is. You know, I don't have a lot of regrets, but I wish I'd had the skills that I now have as a 50, almost 51 year old woman to the 21 year old girl that I was.
Don't we all?
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Because you don't know, right? You make choices that work for you right there in the moment and don't realize the ramifications. Like I didn't even think she'd be hurt that her dad wasn't there for her birth. I thought, well, I'm there. My mom's there. And anyway, it turned out it was good that I was home because the cord was around her neck three times. She came out not breathing. I almost bled out. It was good that I was home and my mom was there because I think it would have been a little too scary to have those things happen. And would it have turned out the way it did with her, you know, being resuscitated and me not bleeding out? Like, who knows, right? The universe is pretty perfect. So I try to look at it, that side of it, you know, and think, well, maybe neither of us would be here if I had been in New Zealand. I mean, not that New Zealand's a third world country, but you don't know medically, you know?
It's also just, it's not, when you're in a moment like that, it's not home, right? Even if you're making it a home, it's not home. It's amazing how all of a sudden things like that become extremely important. And I mean, people listening to you right now are probably like, man, this woman has her ish together. Like, how? I could never be that. But one of the things your writing deals with is I've named it the myth of innate knowledge. You've called it other things, but you know, you've said nothing just happens, right? That no, there are ways of learning this stuff and nobody knows it off the bat. How did you develop this self-compassion and this wisdom, you know, of, well, it probably wasn't what I would do now, but you know what? That doesn't mean it's bad or terrible. It's just different.
Well, I would say that probably got put on me at a very young age. My dad was an alcoholic and he was very neglectful toward me. He only liked my brothers and he ran around. So if he wasn't having sex with a woman, he didn't really know how to treat a woman or what to do with her. So it was kind of just my mom and I, and I watched my mom go through so much crap with him, and then ultimately becoming a single mom and, you know, caring for us three kids. We were all in competitive activities. So I think I learned compassion and to be empathetic by watching her, and then watching that she somehow always made it work. I realized that, okay, well, no matter how bad it gets, you always end up on your feet. And then I also survived sexual abuse twice. So I think it just, you realize that it's not the stuff that happens to you that's important. It's what you do with the stuff that happens to you that's important.
Yeah. Now with that, I mean, you haven't made that your identity. You know, some people make becoming a survivor an identity as opposed to just being one piece of them. Does it concern you that we're living in a trauma culture right now? I mean, yeah. It becomes what you are as opposed to something you experienced.
Yeah, it does. It does concern me. And, you know, it's interesting that you asked me that, because just watching the whole Me Too movement mm-hmm. unfold, it was hard because I, you know, Me Too.
Oh, there are moments I've wanted to vomit in the Harvey Weinstein stuff and yeah. having brushes with that stuff, you know.
Right. And yeah. And you know, so I actually held my tongue a lot on that, because that was during the time when I was writing my daily blog. Mm-hmm. And I have three daughters, and luckily we've gotten them to the point where, you know, they've come through the world to this point where they're safe, and, you know, but they have their Me Too stories too. Mm-hmm. And they could have gone, you know, they could have written diatribes on Facebook, and they could have filed suits and stuff. I think I don't want to undermine how women feel like they need to heal, or are meant to, how people need to heal to in order to feel like they can move forward. Mm-hmm. And there's no right way to say this, and I might get messages after this goes live, but the reality is that, and I said this earlier when we were just chatting, just because it feels that way to you and that was your experience of it, the world doesn't need to know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't need to be like announced. Same with the gender reveal. It's like, I love you. You're awesome. And I pray that your baby is healthy and beautiful and strong. And I hope they do incredible things. And I hope your pregnancy goes well and your delivery and all the things. But it's not the only baby to be born. It's not the only boy. It's not the only girl.
I was like applauding reading your book when you talked, this is not the first child ever to be born.
No. Yeah. And it's the same thing. And I don't want to minimize, as a survivor, I don't want to minimize the impact that rape and abuse and all that trauma that it has on you. But the only person who continues to suffer from what happened to you, if you allow it to own you and to run you and to be you, is you. Mm-hmm. That person is long gone. They unfortunately have probably raped or attacked or done something to another person, and that's on them. Let karma, let the universe, let whatever you believe is the bigger picture, let them handle that. And you only get one life. And this mm-hmm. is how I live. It's like, I only get one life. It goes by in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. I can either spend it wallowing in all the woulda, shoulda, couldas, and the whys, and how come me, and the poor me, and woe is me, and all the things, wasting precious moments that you can never get back. Or I can go, okay, this happened. Not great. Wish it hadn't. But okay, how can I go forward to claim my life back? Mm-hmm. To take it and make it mine, and to own it, and to make it beautiful and wonderful, and have that be like just a snip of my life, not my entire life. And I think people don't have enough people in their lives telling them like to go through it and let it go.
But go not through it. Don't yeah, run around it. In a circle. Go through
100%.
It. Yeah.
Go through now, it, let it go.
This sort of touches on something you said previously, but also something you wrote about women and invisibility. You know, we're sort of, culture focuses on protecting girls. And so when girls aren't protected, it's some sort of mass failure and we all have to feel awful about it. Instead of, no, that guy's an asshole and he's an evil, terrible person. Let's put that on him where it belongs instead of, oh, you were drinking, you were this. But also this idea of feminine invisibility. And you talked about it, about turning 50. But I think we feel invisible until we're about 25, and we do a lot of things to try to draw attention to ourselves that aren't necessarily healthy. And, you know, you've written about it, like, yeah. Oh Lord, you know, 13-year-olds sending nude pics to adult men and stuff like, but it's all an attempt to be seen. Right. Yeah. And then yeah. We have this sort of period in the sun from, like, I don't know, 25 to 35, it's starting to stretch beyond 30. I mean, two women over 40 in the Super Bowl doing things in, like, glittery underwear was a moment. Yeah. But it's like we only have half our lives where we're allowed to be visible.
Yeah.
And, like, you talked about encountering this when you turned 50 and you had a terrible 6 months and then you got through it. How did you get through that?
Well, I think it's the same thing that I was just talking about with, you know, the times that Yannick and I have been broke and eating mm-hmm. bagels and Kraft dinner for dinner with the kids, or eating eggs for dinner when I was a little girl growing up, or being raped or being sexually assaulted. I think it's the same thing. What's most important, I believe, and this is just me, these are my opinions and my feelings and what worked for me, is what I've learned through my years of therapy and millions of dollars I've spent on self-help books, is that what's so very, very important is that to sit with it, right? Like, so to, first of all, to go, what am I feeling right now? Why do I feel this way? First, accumulate the emotion, then sit in it a little bit, mm-hmm. and then start to find the root of them, the issue. Like, okay, well, I'm feeling really on edge. Well, why is that? And dig and look for the root of it, and then go down to the root and pull it out, extract it out, and deal with it. And don't come up and be like, hey, I'm great, until you really are. Mm-hmm. And you know what? And there's nothing wrong with, sometimes that could take 2 days. Sometimes it might take you a few weeks. Sometimes it might take you a few months. As long as you say to the people that are around you, hey, I'm working through something right now. I don't know how long it's going to take me. So please be patient with me. I'm trying to be patient with me. I'm still going to try to be my best version of me. But can you please have some grace for me, because I need it, because I'm going through it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and I say this in my book a lot, communication is key. Humility is key. And then owning things. And giving yourself the space with grace to work through it, and understand that getting to be your full self is a journey, and mm-hmm. it's often very ugly and painful. And a lot of people don't want to even stop and do the work. And if you're listening right now and you're one of those people, I beg you to do the work, because when you come out on the other side, it's so much shinier and more beautiful. And, you know, it's like you said, like, put your face to the sun, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, take that moment of being able to live in the sun rather than living under the clouds.
Yeah. I mean, the point in the Zoomer article where you said, you know, you focused on, oh, I wanted to be a successful actress. And that's what you sort of, I'm like, my God, if a woman with the accomplishments that you have is feeling that way, it almost gives permission for everybody else to have that ugh moment. You know, we talk a lot about aha moments, but we don't permit ourselves those ugh moments, right?
I love that.
Okay.
It's true.
Well, we can co-write a book on ugh moments.
It's like, true. Just, that's such a good way to put it.
I mean, I went through it when, because I was a competitive dancer. I was a musical theater performer as well. And then my appendix blew up. And well, that was that. So I went into comedy, and then I blew my knee out and I couldn't perform in heels anymore. I'm like, fuck, why does these things keep happening to me? But every time you feel ugh for a while, and then you find something new to do. And in a lot of ways, it's better because it's more sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, I, because, you know, as somebody who was like, I'm not sure acting is me anymore and who doesn't regret leaving it behind. And sometimes, I don't know if you see scenes on certain TV shows and instead of being aware of what's going on, you just think about how horrible and awkward it must have been for the performers doing it. You know, certain scenes in Game of Thrones, I'm like, they must have just, like, what was that set like?
Yeah. Oh, so much. And yeah. I look at, I'm watching my husband too, and I'm like, I'm kind of lucky because he's really hunky, but he's never had to roll around fully naked for days on end with hot chicks. You know what I mean? I'm like, thank God the wife he has on TV right now, it's a period piece and they're fully dressed. And even when they're in
bed. There's so much tension though. Like, how do you handle that? It's so convincing. Do you watch the show? And it's like, I need to go now.
You know what? I don't mind watching the show. What I mind is when people are stupid on the internet and they okay. message me and they're like, oh my God, William and Julia. Oh my, like that. I don't have time for that. Like, don't pull me into your fantasy of William and Julia because you know, they're both acting.
Well, and you're not married to Murdoch.
No, and I'm not married to Murdoch. And, you know, I got that when I first got on social media. Oh, man, yeah. Did I get that all the time? That's not fitting of William Murdoch's wife. Well, William Murdoch's wife is not me.
I get told I'm married to a sock.
Yeah.
Like, and I just say from now on, I've been accused of worse.
Yeah, I've been accused of worse.
It's weird, though. Do you ever feel like getting back to this visibility and reality? Like, it's like we spend our entire lives now trying to determine what's real.
Yeah.
You know, what's real and what's meaningful. And when did we hand over the keys to the rest of the world to this? Like, did we never had a chance because of shit like gender assignment parties. That's a different thing entirely. Gender reveal parties. 40 and slip that way because I mean that's in a lot of ways when people reclaim their gender, when people, you know, have those parties, they're casting off those expectations, right?
Well, yeah, and it seems funny to me too, right? Because here we are, we're in a time where people are choosing their gender, mm-hmm. whether because legitimately they identify as that or you know, hormonal, I don't mm-hmm. know. You know, my kids were all born female and they all identify as female. So I it's the same thing. Somebody wrote a review on my book and they were like, well, she just doesn't even address special needs parenting or autism. Well, how can I address that? I didn't have an autistic child and I don't have a special needs child. It would be the same thing if I wrote a book telling parents how not to lose their cool when their child determines that, oh, they were born, you know, Bobby, but now they want to be Betty.
Right.
Like, how can I write that book? That would be arrogant and it would be disrespectful.
See, to me, I thought you did kind of touch on that, but they missed it because it wasn't exactly that. It was the microwave thing.
Yeah.
And I struggled with the microwave thing. I'm like, how does anybody go through 30 years of a kid and never use a microwave? Like, how is this possible? But then near the end, and you were so sneaky about the way you did this, you made me struggle with the microwave thing and feeling inferior because, oh my God, I'm not giving up my microwave and all that stuff. And then at the end, you're like, yes, I am aware I'm on the extreme end of that. And it was like, oh, that was a cool journey because you just sold it. You went all in. And then later you're like, yeah, I know that's kind of crazy. And it's like it gave everybody else permission to have their own weird.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. You know what I mean? It's like, and we're so busy judging and we're so busy with our eyes in everybody else's backyard and deciding that people are doing it wrong because they're not doing it the way we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And the reality is like, however somebody wants to do something, raise their kid, use a microwave, not use a microwave, use Wi-Fi, not use Wi-Fi. However you want to do that, that choice is yours. But I say this about everything. Go collect your information, mm-hmm. get educated, and then make an educated decision about if you're going to continue on in that path, then do it. And if you're not, then cool. If I can open your eyes to just at least explore that possibly these articles that I've read and the literature that I've researched is accurate and these things are dangerous, then hey, again, it's like if 100 people, you know, stop having those Wi-Fi baby monitors next to their baby's heads while they're sleeping because they realize that the reality is, and it's sad to say, and my brother, my younger brother, almost he was resuscitated from SIDS is that monitor's not waking you up anyway.
Yeah, I wonder about baby monitors in that regard. It seems to be more of a parent feeling like they're doing everything they can than you can't see. I know I've been babysitting people's kids and stuff like that, and they have the monitor, and it's like, I can't tell if the kid's sleeping or dead based on this little grainy image in the dark, right?
Yeah.
And I thought that was very eye-opening. Now, I never got the sense you were telling people absolutely never use a microwave, never have Wi-Fi on after 11 o'clock, and throw out your baby monitor. It was this is what was right for me. And what I thought was cool and what I thought was universal is that you weren't saying it was right for everybody else. It was the courage to say, this was right for me, and I stand by that I found so instructive.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, I had to do some work, right? And if you get through the boundaries and accountability chapter, I love the modeling apologizing, and especially admitting when you weren't terribly good to your spouse.
Yeah.
And teaching kids that, because I think that's something a lot of women didn't get an example of at home.
No. And I think, you know, again, parenting, right? And I say this in my book too, is like, my mom was an awesome mom. Mm-hmm. Now, are there things that happened in our relationship, A, that I wish I'd never put her through? Absolutely. Are there things and ways that I would have liked, now that I'm a mom, that I would have preferred and liked for her to handle certain things that happened to me in a different way? Yes. Am I going to hold it over her? No. Does she hold it over me? No. And I think that I wish, and we seem to be going backward, I wish we would just all have more grace, mm-hmm. more grace to one another, more grace for people who, like, you know, people are up in arms about how people identify as a gender. People are up in arms about who people love, color, race, religion, gender. I just don't understand. I don't understand. What difference does it make to anybody else who somebody is in their own skin and who somebody loves? And if somebody is not out there, like, being legitimately a terrorist, then why does it really matter what they're doing at home and with whom? So, you know, we always raised our girls like that. We raised, like, all we want you to do is find a love with a person who treats you the way you deserve to be treated. We don't care what they look like. We don't care the package they come in. We don't care what religion they are. We don't care what gender they are. And we really meant that. And we raise them that way, and we hold to that to this day. And I just find that we're so preoccupied, I feel like, as a society, worrying about what people think about us or what we think about other people, that we're distracted. We're living distracted lives. And I think why I wrote this book is, like, to stop being distracted, focus on your family, focus on this child that you know, in some cases, many people fought hard to conceive mm-hmm. and to have, and do a good job. I mean, we all watch sports and idolize sports and famous performers and singers. And we have this huge appreciation for these people that achieve to the top of their field. And yet we're kind of okay if our kid tells us to, you know, kiss my ass. They don't want to listen to me. Oh, it's just him being him or her being her. It's like, no, you don't get to that level of being a human being by being allowed to be the worst version of yourself.
Well said. And you can tell you've got a ton of experience in media because you brought it all around to where we began. I can't think of a better place to wrap. So well done. You did your own interview. Chantal Bisson, everybody, her book is Raising Your Kids Without Losing Your Cool. By the time this airs, I'm sure she'll start another 16 businesses because she's cool like that. Chantal, thanks so much for your time, and hope to have you back on another topic because you're so eloquent on so much stuff.
Oh, thank you. I would love to. It was a very good time.
This is Fun, the FU Network.